Greetings, friends. Welcome back to another critically acclaimed podcast commentary track. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic. I contribute to /film. With me, as always, is actually William is not here right now. William is away on a writer's retreat. Good on him. I'm very proud of him, and I'm proud of the work he's doing there. But while he's away, we haven't had a lot of chances to record, so I'm filling out the schedule a little bit with this commentary track. I am doing a commentary track for Olatunde Osusanmi's 2025 action science fiction picture Star Trek Section 31, a spin-off of Star Trek Discovery, a film with a lot of problems. It might be the worst film in the Star Trek series, but we'll get to that. I will be talking about it very shortly. If you would like to sync up, the film is available on Paramount Plus. Just queue it up, and I will start as soon as the film begins. I'll let you set that up. Welcome back. Be prepared to hit play as soon as I say engage. 3, 2, 1, engage. And here we are. So, Section 31, that is the organization from within the Star Trek universe, began an episode of Deep Space Nine back in the 1990s, and it was always a little bit shady, and it was presented as such in Deep Space Nine. It was sort of like the CIA of the Federation. It did a lot of like black ops stuff and was really sort of doing all the spy and assassin work behind the scenes. They were this really shadowy cabal, and they were sort of presented as this dark mirror of what the Federation stood for, what Starfleet stood for, all of these ideals that Gene Roddenberry had set up in Star Trek and in Star Trek The Next Generation were undergirded, it seems, by all of these sinful things. Of course, if you need to commit secret assassins and have a secret police that's murdering people in the shadows in order to retain your utopia, well, guess what? You don't have a utopia. In the original Deep Space Nine episodes, Section 31 appeared to Dr. Bashir to sort of tempt him to become a member. And I think the organization, at least in terms of like screenwriting, in terms of plot, stood as a test for that character, for Dr. Bashir. Would he do the shady things and hide out if he was convinced that such evils were necessary to retain the utopia? And very rightly so, he rejected that idea. He turned Section 31 down. For some reason, Alex Kurtzman, the new executive producer of the whole Star Trek franchise as it currently stands, starting from 2017, and also the J.J. Abrams movies, has become really attached to the idea of Section 31. And it's been really frustrating listening to Alex Kurtzman talk about Section 31, because he seems to feel that it really is a necessary thing within the universe of Star Trek. He feels that a utopia can't be held together unless you have some violence or some war undergirding it. It's really, really frustrating listening to Alex Kurtzman talk about Star Trek in general, because he clearly doesn't buy it. I don't think he ever really liked Star Trek. That's really clear when you watch sort of the J.J. Abrams movies, because those are films that are predicated on action and violence and, you know, murdering the bad guys, you know, typical action movie stuff. But, you know, things that aren't necessarily the backbone of what Star Trek is. And wouldn't you know it, you know, Alex Kurtzman and J.J. Abrams and all the rest of them who worked on those Kelvinverse movies never really bought into the utopia of Star Trek. I think they always felt that it was a little too cold. You can also listen to interviews with J.J. Abrams talking about how Star Trek was a little bit cold and distant to him, and he always preferred Star Wars, which is a little bit more about, you know, bigger characters and archetypes and action and simple solutions. He could wrap his mind around that. But after several years of overseeing Star Trek on Paramount Plus, Section 31, this movie, came at a really unusual time. Star Trek Discovery, which was co-created by Kurtzman, debuted on Paramount Plus in 2017. It was followed shortly thereafter by shows like Star Trek Picard and Star Trek Lower Decks. And there was actually a very brief period when six Star Trek shows were running simultaneously. One of them was Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which was a spinoff of Discovery. The original plan was to have Star Trek Discovery and then spin off Section 31 out of that. One of the conceits of Discovery was that the ship, the USS Discovery, went into the mirror universe where, the Spock with a beard comes from, where everybody's kind of evil and compromised. And they found that Captain Philippa Georgiou, played by Michelle Yeoh, lived in that universe as the Empress. She was the leader of this evil universe. And Empress Georgiou is one of the most evil characters on Star Trek. She has murdered literally billions. They say so in the Section 31 movie. She's a cannibal. In Discovery, it was revealed that she had eaten Saru, the character played by Doug Jones. And in Section 31, she's actually seen eating a human eyeball. So, and also owns Doomsday devices. So she's still not a good person. This whole intro that we're watching, where she's sort of being tested to become Empress by killing these people. First of all, it doesn't make any... It contradicts what we already know about the Mirror Universe, as was established in Mirror Mirror and other Mirror Universe episodes of Star Trek. Mirror Mirror, that is the original series episode where we first saw this parallel universe, is that it's sort of right by assassination. If you are clever enough to kill your superior officer and usurp their place, you get to usurp the throne. And this is really seen as really common in the Mirror Universe. That's not what's happening here in this intro. She's being tested to become Empress by entering some kind of Hunger Games style contest. She and her friend San defeated the other contestants in this contest in the Terran Empire. It doesn't make any sense. This is a very, very frustrating film. You're going to hear that noise a lot over the course of this commentary track. As we followed in Discovery, Empress Georgiou was whisked away from the Mirror Universe and brought into the main Star Trek universe. In fans call it the Prime Universe. And she became sort of a reluctant member of the Discovery crew. There was a two-part episode in Discovery where she kind of was able to slip through a dimensional portal back into her own universe and kind of had a reckoning with her own moral center. She had actually kind of grown a conscience. She didn't really like the person she had become anymore. And then she escaped the Mirror Universe again and came back to the Prime Universe. She faced the Guardian of Forever, who in Discovery was played by a guy in a hat, and was allowed to, in his words, go back to a time when the Mirror Universe and the Prime Universe were more aligned. First of all, it's unbearably frustrating that they use those terms in dialogue within Star Trek. Those were fan terms, Mirror Universe and Prime Universe, but now that's just part of Star Trek canon. That's what they call them, Prime Universe, Mirror Universe. And when were those two universes aligned? Now, that makes it sound like she would have gone back in time to a point where those two universes were identical, and at some point they were going to diverge, and the Mirror Universe was going to become evil, and the Star Trek universe would continue apace. The problem is, thanks to an episode of Star Trek Enterprise, and yes, I'm going to get this nerdy throughout this. I'm going to make all these complaints. Don't worry about it. I'm going to get real deep into this. I'm also going to run out of shit to say about this pretty awful film later on, so I may as well get this all off my chest right away. But in a two-part episode of Star Trek Enterprise, it was called In a Mirror Darkly, it, very cleverly, that entire episode was set inside the Mirror Universe, and we only spent time with the evil characters. So there was an evil Captain Archer, and an evil T'Pol, and an evil Hoshi Sato, all the rest. the opening credits for that two-part episode very cleverly also seem to be ported over from the Mirror Universe. So rather than have that really insufferable Rod Stewart song over the opening credits, they had this whole montage of the Enterprise firing on things, you know, sort of the evolution of travel. And that was the montage at the beginning of every Enterprise episode. It was this montage of old-timey sailing ships and then modern ships and then finally starships. The In a Mirror Darkly opening was that same montage, but the ships were all on missions of conquest. They were conquering and shooting bombs, and it ended with the Enterprise firing missiles and blowing up planet surfaces. So it's implied through that title sequence that Philippa Georgiou must have gone back to a time before the 18th century to when the two universes were more aligned. Problem is, she doesn't, and we're actually hearing this information right now through this exposition dump given by Jamie Lee Curtis. She doesn't go back in time to when those two universes were more aligned. She actually goes forward in time, I think, to a time just before the, like, maybe a couple decades before the events of Star Trek The Next Generation. So she's actually living at a time after all of the original six Star Trek movies, but before the beginning of Next Generation. We can see this because of the character of Rachel Garrett. Rachel Garrett, in this TV movie, what was her name? Was played by Casey Roll, an actress named Casey Roll. She showed up in the episode Yesterday's Enterprise of Star Trek The Next Generation. So here we see a younger version of that character. She's supposed to state, you know, when it takes place, but there's a little bit of an error because the star date they give doesn't quite match up to that. It's a little bit of a mess. It's almost like the screenwriters didn't really care where this took place in the Star Trek universe. And in fact, apart from Captain Rachel Garrett, there isn't really much of a connection between this movie and the rest of the Star Trek universe. And in fact, this is so far removed, not just from the timeline of Star Trek, but geographically. We actually just saw in this introduction as well that it is outside of Federation space in this big seashell-looking ship where Philippa Georgiou is hanging out. It has nothing to do with, like, a lot of established species. We see a couple established species. There's a mecha suit that looks like a Vulcan. There's a Delton that was Persis Kambata's species from Star Trek The Motion Picture. There is a Camaloid. The character of Quasi is a Camaloid. He was a species last seen in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. There are some superficial connections to Star Trek, but this has nothing to do with Star Trek history. It has nothing to do with Star Trek politics, and it may as well not be Star Trek. Really, it just is a spy action caper starring Star Trek adjacent characters. There's a Starfleet officer there. That's the Rachel Garrett character. She joins this little ragtag group of misfits that are part of Section 31. And she's there to make sure that they don't murder people, but they do anyway. Like, people die in this movie. But if she's there to make sure they don't murder people, how come she's not saying more about how they need to straighten up and fly right, that they are actually employees of Starfleet or of the Federation, and that they actually need to do this thing as maybe secretly, but at least as ethically as possible. There's no talking of ethics. In fact, I'm not really sure what the purpose of telling Empress Georgiou's story is. I think Alex Kurtzman just liked the idea of a supervillain, played by the incomparable Michelle Yeoh, of course, leading a Star Trek TV series. I think one of the issues with this movie is it's a movie, and it was originally envisioned as a TV series. It was originally supposed to be the first spinoff of Discovery, immediately after Discovery debuted. They got Michelle Yeoh. She's a worldwide superstar. You get her as much as you can. They actually introduced the fact that she was going to join Section 31 in the first season of Star Trek Discovery, when she kind of snuck off and joined this sort of black ops ship. And, of course, thanks to COVID, a lot of that was delayed. Thanks to Michelle Yeoh winning an Academy Award, she probably wouldn't be available or just didn't want to do a TV series anymore. So they kind of reduced it and rewrote it and turned it into this very short feature film that really rushed a story and feels like it needed a little bit more time to breathe. Just so you can introduce the characters a little bit more. The characters, in a caper, in like sort of a generic action caper kind of way, are fine. What we're looking at here with Section 31 is a film that looks and feels a lot like a Sci-Fi Channel original movie from the mid-90s. It has the same sort of shallow action tropes. It has the same kind of very broad characterizations. You could just call this Space Heist 3000 and release it in 1998, and it would have been exactly the same and probably gotten the same kind of reception from audiences. It came out in 2025, and it's a Star Trek movie. It turns into one of the worst things you've ever seen. So here we have Empress Georgiou talking to a character named Alok. He's played by Omari Hardwick. He is... And this is what I mean when we're, because right now we're just sort of introducing all of the characters in this really fast montage. They're not building a team. They're already there. So we've rushed a lot of the establishment. Do we like these characters? Do we dislike them? The director is very clumsy about it. So yeah, Alok is a human from Earth in the 20th century who was frozen and who fell in with eugenics soldiers from the eugenics wars that Khan led, and he was thawed out, and now he's living in the timeline of Section 31. We're introduced to Kwasi, who's played by Sam Richardson, and I really like Sam Richardson. He was really good in that film, Werewolves Within. He plays the Kameloid. He's a shapeshifter. They added some CGI to the shapeshifting effect, so rather than just sort of slurping into another person's face, he very briefly turns into this big CGI mess of tendrils and then reforms. It's fine. Whatever. We have Zeff. He's played by Robert Kaczynski. He's a guy in a mecha suit. The idea of human beings just sort of naturally having mechanical enhancements as a matter of choice is something that cropped up occasionally in Star Trek novels before it became a really kind of permanent part of Star Trek canon in Star Trek Lower Decks. The character of Rutherford, the animated series, he had a brain implants and something over his eye that helped his brain work more efficiently and allowed him to see things better. And it's implied that he just sort of had that done because he wanted to. I remember in one of the Star Trek novels, I forgot which one. It might have been Blaze of Glory, a Next Generation novel. There was a character who had like medical enhancements. They had like these pockets installed inside their body that contained all these different kinds of medicines, and they could gallivant around the galaxy, like curing people with like little needles in their fingertips. I thought that was a pretty cool idea. I have a feeling that we don't see that on Star Trek a lot. A, because the makeup would be too expensive. B, it becomes a little bit ethically dodgy. Like, I don't think Star Trek was ready to tell a story of, like, a ship of Theseus about a human body sort of story, where if somebody gets enough of their body parts replaced, are they still the original person? That kind of story. Sadly, that never really came up. But now we have Zeff, who wears this gigantic mech suit, and I guess he works as a vigilante? I mean, sure, that's a fine idea. I know the technology in Star Trek is enough to handle that sort of thing, but it looks wrong. He looks like a big bruiser. He looks like something out of Alita Battle Angel. He doesn't look like he fits into the Star Trek universe. I think... anyway, the rest of the characters, we have Rachel Garrett. She's played by Casey Roll. We have Sven Roigrok playing the character of Fuzz. And he is actually a microscopic organism who is piloting a very humanoid-looking suit who looks like a Vulcan. And he's played by Sven Roigrok. I like that idea. I actually think that's pretty great. I don't like the shots inside the nano suit. I would like the idea better if we just sort of intellectually saw him and he behaved a little bit weird, but that's because we knew that he was piloted by this microscopic super intelligent organism. That's kind of a neat idea. I like that. I don't think the character is handled very well, but I like the idea. And that's, oh, and there's also Mel, played by Umberly Gonzalez. She's a Delton, and just like in Star Trek The Motion Picture, it's implied that Deltons are just sexually irresistible, and she's able to seduce just about everyone, except, of course, for Quasi, because he's a shapeshifter. I don't know exactly how that's supposed to work, but he is immune to her charms. Don't get too attached to Mel. She's going to get killed pretty quickly. But we get together this ragtag group of characters. They're not part of Starfleet. They don't live on a starship. And they all come from the non-Starfleet parts of the Star Trek universe. And a big, big issue that Star Trek has always had is depicting what the world looks like outside of Starfleet or off of a starship or a space station. Star Trek is, and I've always maintained this, has always been a workplace show, first and foremost. It's about people's jobs. It's about a managerial position. It's about captains and their commanders and all and the rank and the chain of command they're in. We just happen to be following characters who have a really great job. They get to work in the engineering section. They get to work in the medical section. It's all about the departments and the different jobs people have. It's rare that we'll spend a lot of time with civilians in the Star Trek universe, unless it's how they interact with Starfleet characters, like Jake Sisko. He's not an officer, but his dad is. Or there's a lot of characters who aren't in Starfleet yet, but would really like to be. So when we leave Starfleet and we go to some place where people are just sort of working in cities or living in houses or living in trailers, Star Trek has always floundered a little bit. There's not been a guiding ethos as to what civilian life looks like. I feel like that has always been a little bit abstract to Star Trek viewers. And I think it's because Starfleet is out there, reallocating resources. We have all these miracle technologies in Star Trek, right? We have replicators and faster than light travel. The idea is civilian life is now the utopian part of the universe, because you can do whatever you like. You're not going to starve. You have unlimited free food. You have the ability and the resources to do whatever you like in this universe. You want to be a vintner? We'll find you a planet where you can grow grapes. You want to be a beekeeper? We'll find a species of bees that can be kept here. Because of our faster-than-light travel, we can take you there and you can just have it, and everything is free. We just need to make sure everything is properly allocated. And as such, I think civilian life in Star Trek would be pretty broad and undefinable, because everybody gets to just sort of do what they want. You want to open a restaurant? Open a restaurant. Give away free food. Make Cajun cooking to your heart's content. Try to perfect it. Make whatever you like. Do whatever you like. And I feel like everyone has sort of understood that in the civilian world of Star Trek, and they just sort of go about their business. So that's not a very dramatic place to tell stories when everybody is always happy and always gets what they want. So when it comes time to actually show civilian life, the writers of Star Trek panic. They can't really show what civilian life looks like in a utopian sense. There's no drama there. There's no conflict. So what they have to do is find the corners of civilian Star Trek world where things aren't utopian yet, where there's still crime, and there's still drugs, and there's still violence, and there's still weapons, and there's still money, and tell the stories there. And that's where we are with Section 31. we had to find a corner of the Star Trek universe outside of Federation space where we could tell a pretty typical violent spy crime story. There's that transformation effect. Where sort of the utopia doesn't apply. Alex Kurtzman and Osun Sanmi were just so uninterested in telling any kind of utopian Star Trek story. And that's been clear since Kurtzman started making Discovery back in 2017. He just does not have any interest whatsoever in telling a story about a utopia. He doesn't want to tell stories about diplomacy. He doesn't want to tell stories about exploration or scientific knowledge. And quite frankly, he's not even good at telling action stories, as evidenced by Section 31. Section 31 feels like it was rushed. There's a lot in this movie where they're sort of like sandwiching in a lot of quick cuts. And this, you'll notice this once you you'll never stop noticing this once you start seeing it happening. There's a lot of digital snap zooms in this movie. These, that is, they took a shot and then they artificially zoomed in really quick, to make it look a little bit more handheld and immediate. And it just makes the film look ugly. It looks like it wasn't planned. All these little zooms, ins and outs. It looks like they're trying to cover for something. And I'm guessing that might have been the case. Yeah, gosh. It just is a really, really tough sit. Again, if Kurtzman and company wanted to make an actual science fiction caper movie that had nothing to do with Star Trek, well, first of all, this film still wouldn't work, but they could do it. I'm thinking of a film like Eliminators. There's a really wonderful film from the late 80s called Eliminators, which is about a time-traveling villain who has to be stopped at the hands of a heroic mandroid, like a guy with tank treads for legs. Denise Crosby is there. There's a martial arts expert, and there's like this Indiana Jones knockoff character. All of those people have to sort of team up and stop a time-traveling bad guy. Fun, pulpy comic book stuff. And I actually like Eliminators. It's not great, but I like it. I like how earnest it is. It had this sort of frank low-budget need to entertain, the sort of B-movie sensibility where they're going to do the best they can with the budget they have. And that sort of earnest need to entertain is missing from something like Section 31. It feels really cynical. It feels like they had all of these ideas from Star Trek that were left over from the TV show, that were left over from Discovery, that they just felt this bloody-minded need to pursue. Oh, gosh. And here we are with the godsend. This is the big MacGuffin of Section 31, that thing in the briefcase that this guy was carrying. This, I think, is a neat idea that you can have people or objects that are sort of within a certain kind of vibrational phase where they can only touch each other, but they can only touch the things like on the same frequency and they can't touch anything else. So they can pass through walls, but pick up things. That reminded me of that interdimensional sequence from Valerian. I thought that was pretty neat. But here we are with Empress Georgiou. She's out of phase. She has this weird cubic object. It looks like it should be called MacGuffin. They may as well just have called it the MacGuffin. And it's going to be revealed that this is called the Godsend. The Godsend inside is a doomsday device. Oh, God. And I think they even use the word super weapon at some point. You know that you've run out of ideas, that filmmakers or artists have run out of ideas if they do one of the following. That they have a super weapon as your MacGuffin. Or you have a villain that is motivated by blood revenge. These are very, very common because they're tired. Sometimes they work, but they've worked less and less recently in recent years. This is, maybe the fifth, sixth Star Trek movie in a row that has a villain who was motivated by blood revenge. And we'll get to that. It's no big spoilers. It's San, the boy we saw at the beginning of the movie. He comes back. His motivations are very unclear. He actually plays a pretty minor part in the movie. He's the main villain, and he plays a minor part in the movie. somebody needs to go into the Paramount offices and just start putting posters all over the walls that just say, no doomsday weapons, no revenge. I'm so tired of those kinds of stories. I'm so tired of them in Star Trek. And they're so uncreative, and they also don't fall in with the kind of stern scientific thinking that Star Trek is known for. Star Trek doesn't typically deal with super weapons. Okay, yes, they have phasers, but phasers are enough to wipe out a planet, right? If the Enterprise D were so inclined, it could probably just zap around an entire planet's surface and kill all of its citizens within a matter of hours. The point is, that's not what power is in the Star Trek universe. Not the ability to dominate, not the ability to destroy, but the ability to grow and change and help people and talk to people. Your moral standing is where power comes from. These are the movies that still think that power comes at the end of a phaser. You point a gun at somebody, you're more powerful than them, and if you have this powerful super weapon that can destroy the universe, that's the most important thing to concern yourself with. I hate all that stuff. I hate it so much. This is so bad. People bursting through walls and saying, yikes. This whole ragtag group of misfits thing comes at the end of, not at the end, it's just one of many, of a kind of a recent trend of these types of movies, where they're kind of irreverent, all of these characters hate each other, but they learn to be a team. This is the same sort of thing that happened in Guardians of the Galaxy, a movie that many, many people are fond of. It weirdly happened with the movie Borderlands, and I feel like this movie has a lot to do with Borderlands. It has a lot to do with David Ayer's Suicide Squad and James Gunn's follow-up, The Suicide Squad. This idea of kind of roguish, amoral, not exactly upstanding characters having to unite for a quest, and it is presumed at least becoming somewhat noble along the way. In fact, Jamie Lee Curtis, who has a cameo in this one, we'll see here at the end of the movie, she also has a cameo she has one of the main roles in Borderlands. Why are we here with Star Trek? Why are we imitating bombs like The Suicide Squad and Borderlands? I just don't know why they had to push forward with this. Like, they had a TV show, it fell apart, it had to be reworked. They tried to develop it into something, but I don't see what Philippa Georgiou's arc is supposed to be. She's a villain at the beginning of this one. And if she's supposed to be the one villain, wouldn't it make a lot more sense if she was surrounded by a bunch of moral characters? Which is kind of what they tried to do on Star Trek Discovery, but these shows are so action-oriented and so violent that she didn't stand out as particularly evil. I think Michael Burnham kills just as many people on camera as Emperor Georgiou over the course of these movies. Here's how you tell this story. Okay, you have an evil cannibal empress from a parallel universe who has killed billions, and she's taken into the utopia of Star Trek. She is also, however, incredibly intelligent or incredibly talented. She knows villains psychologically. She's like the Hannibal Lecter. Imagine if, like, it's an FBI thriller, but they just sort of bring Hannibal Lecter along. That's your tone, right? It should be a Star Trek series about Starfleet officers going on a secret mission, and the one secret aspect is that Empress Georgiou is there. She is the one who, she's like the wild card. She's the one that you can't predict. And maybe over the course of the film, she learns something, or maybe she tries to corrupt the Starfleet officers and serves as a test, just the way Section 31 did to Dr. Bashira back on Deep Space Nine. But that's not the angle they went for. She's not the one standout. She's actually just one of many other villains. What you have is a villain force of amoral characters who are only saving the universe because, A, Empress Georgiou created this doomsday device, so now she doesn't want the universe to end. And also the other characters who are brought along because they've been ordered or they've been forced to. I'm not exactly sure what they are getting out of this. I don't know what Giorgio is supposed to have learned. She doesn't seem humbled by the end. It's revealed that, like Professor Farnsworth on Futurama, she has this whole collection of doomsday devices. If this was the premise of the show, if she had decided to turn over a new leaf and the show was about seeking out and destroying those doomsday devices, that would be different. That would actually be really a good premise for a show, of a Section 31 show, where it was revealed that Starfleet knew about this, but they can't get rid of all of these doomsday devices, so they send Empress Giorgio out there on a Starfleet vessel to find them and deactivate them all. And maybe she's a little reluctant to do so, or maybe she's really eager to do so. Either way, it's about sort of cleaning up a little bit of immoral, dangerous mess that is sort of lurking throughout the galaxy. All of these doomsday weapons, how do we get rid of them? No, this is just a doomsday weapon as a MacGuffin. It has no actual moral standing. And I don't know where any of these characters begin or end. They all seem to be unchanged by the end, except for the ones who die. We already saw Mel die. I understand that killing one of your main characters is supposed to give your movie stakes, in old screenwriter's terms. These are supposed to be the things that sort of communicate to the audience that everything's really, really serious now. Somebody can die. If somebody can die, anybody can die. And now everything seems that much more dangerous. But the tone of this movie is actually really light and comedic, so killing a character feels really inappropriate. I've also kind of bristled at the idea of killing main characters in terms of creativity. I feel like it's the cheapest way to generate drama. You kill somebody. Okay, that's like the easy way out. It's easy to write somebody dying, and it's easy to write the resulting drama. Living for the story requires a lot more creativity. It forces the writers to sort of face their characters a little bit more. Wouldn't it have been neat if Mel, this hypersexual character, was in a situation where maybe she could seduce the movie's villain, or maybe she couldn't seduce the movie's villain, or maybe she was a compulsive seducer and got them into a lot of trouble because she was constantly flirting with people? No, they just kill her off to show that stakes are raised, and it just feels so cheap. Also, you know, the character didn't really get to do anything. Humberly Gonzalez was hired to play this part, and then they just murdered her. So what? Oh my gosh, I don't care. I saw an interview with Olatunde Osunsanmi and Alex Kurtzman, and they argued that this was a story of redemption, which it isn't. First of all, Empress Giorgio is irredeemable. It's like the people who like the stories of Darth Vader's redemption. Oh, he was redeemed because he killed the Emperor at the end of Return of the Jedi, forgetting that he had already blown up a planet and deliberately murdered billions as sort of a negotiation tactic. He's not a good guy. He doesn't get to be redeemed. Maybe he won't kill somebody. Maybe he'll do something kind of nice at the end, but that's not enough to sort of cleanse him and bring him over to the light side of the Force, right? I feel the same way about Empress Giorgio. She probably does feel terrible on some level for the things she's done. We kind of see it a little bit, but at the same time, she's really happy and really gleeful about how evil she can be. She likes shocking people about how evil she can be. So she's actually clearly not working toward redemption, nor are there moral people around her encouraging redemption. She's just doing stuff now in the employ of Starfleet. It would be like, imagine Darth Vader, or better yet, imagine the Emperor from Star Wars, if he was teamed up with a bunch of rebels. Like, could he be redeemed? Could he start treating people well? Not after he's clearly this, like, cackling warlock in a cloak who can shoot lightning from his fingers. He's a monster. He's like a Universal movie monster. Maybe there's a story to be told there. Maybe there's a fun story about an evil, murderous emperor or empress who can spend some time with good guys and, if not redeem themselves, at least be controlled in some sort of way, or at least directed to do good against their will. Empress Georgiou isn't doing anything against her will. She's kind of been ordered, but it's not like her hand is being forced. She is told she's not supposed to kill anybody, but she doesn't have any compulsion about actually killing anybody. Like I said, she was eating a human eyeball at the beginning of the movie. She's still eating people, for God's sake. And then you give her with this ragtag group of misfits who just sort of go around trying to get this doomsday device. Oh, gosh, this film is just so, so bad. And I'm not the only one complaining about this movie. Nobody really liked this film. It didn't get a good critical response. It didn't get... I haven't spoken to anybody, any Trekkies, or just anybody in the Star Trek community who was really, really fond of Section 31. A lot of articles came out when this film was released, sort of ranking all 14 of the Star Trek feature films to date. And this one was kind of invariably at the bottom. This was a movie that wasn't supposed to be made. It feels like nobody wanted to make it. I sense that Michelle Yeoh was under contract and was about a topic that only Alex Kurtzman was interested in. It has a 20, as of this recording, it has a 20% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And let me look up how many reviews that was based on. It's important to, when you're talking about Rotten Tomatoes, to remember that don't refer to it as a score. It is just an approval rating. It's a percentage of critics that gave it a plus or a minus review, a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Some critics liked sort of how just a sort of shallow action visuals. I'll say this: it looks fine, as these modern Star Trek shows and films have gone. The interiors aren't necessarily creatively realized, but they at least feel like real physical spaces. Something that they've been doing on a lot of modern TV shows, and on the new Star Trek shows in particular, is shooting with... Cyborg Man there can't decide whether it's pronounced God's End or Godsend. And it has nothing to do with anything, and it's not funny, and it just goes on and on. I hate this scene so much. Anyway, modern Star Trek has been shooting with what they call the AR wall. AR stands for augmented reality. And it's essentially a set. It's like a set within a circular TV screen. And the TV screens are so sophisticated that they can actually... not just create any background they want on these TV screens, but the CGI composited backgrounds are actually, through very sophisticated technology, tied into the live movements of the camera. So a cameraman can walk around inside this AR wall, doing handheld camera work, and the backgrounds will adjust slightly to make it look like the actors are sort of inside this 3D space. It's a good way to save money. It doesn't look great. You can always tell that the actors are usually sort of within the same, like, a 13-foot by 13-foot set. Like, they're not walking very far within these sets, but the backgrounds, I think, look fine for TV, for something that's shooting on a budget. It's no different from having just a really good backdrop or matte painting. It's just the modern version of that. And also, fun thing with the AR wall, the cinematographers who shoot with it can actually alter the image to create lighting sources. So they can actually use this AR wall as a lighting source. They can get people lit from all different kinds of angles. The lighting can change as the camera moves. It's actually pretty novel. I think it's a pretty neat technology. I noticed that the actors can't move very far within it, but you know, this is Star Trek. They used to have, you know, matte green background skies and ficus plants to represent an alien world and styrofoam rocks. This is just the modern version of that. They're working within a budget. The AR wall is not something I'm going to bristle at. And as such, because they're using this AR wall, they can go to all these different locations, and it actually looks okay. There is, apart from all of those snap zooms and the quick camera movements, there is an overuse of close-ups. There's at least a certain level of production value that makes Section 31 at the very least more watchable than some other modern recent action movies. Michelle Yeoh does what she can. I think she's having a good time. I think she understands that this is a pretty good paycheck. I'm wondering if Michelle Yeoh, who worked with Jamie Lee Curtis on Everything Everywhere All at Once, sort of brought in Jamie Lee Curtis. Like, hey, Jamie, we're making a Star Trek movie. They give really good paychecks. You want to come? Oh, no, it sucks, but yeah, no, come, it's going to be great. But yeah, it doesn't... Yeah, there aren't really big concepts here. We have learned that this Doomsday device, of course, came over from the Mirror Universe, the Terror and Empire, they refer to it as. And there's a port, like this little aperture in space where the bad guy can take it through and reconquer the Terran Empire. It really is not all that important. And this isn't just an issue with Section 31, but with a lot of modern action entertainment in general. When the action and the incident, actually, this isn't just action. This is any kind of screenwriting lesson. I'm fond of stories that are about something, that have some kind of theme. It doesn't have to be terribly sophisticated. It's better if it is, but it doesn't have to be, you know, super deeply philosophical, but it has to be about something. Is Section 31 about Empress Georgiou's redemption? Is it about regret? Is it about the need for evil in a perfect world? Is it about the non-existence of a perfect world? All of these things are kind of lurking in the background, but it's not really addressed in the movie visually or in dialogue. The tendency when you can't think of what your movie is going to be about is to focus on plot. It's to focus on incident. Section 31 is 100% incident. It's just about the things that happen, and then this happens, and then this happens. It's not about trying to tell a story. It's just about recording shit that happened. And that's sloppy. This whole thing is just... it's just a big, sloppy, meaningless mess. And, you know, to go back to Eliminators for a minute, those kinds of meaningless stories can still be fun. I feel like there is a scrappy quality to B-movies, the sort of earnest need to entertain that I can really enjoy. Even if a movie's not about something, I appreciate when somebody's working very hard to entertain me. I've said on the podcast before, I like action movies where they'll just go out to the desert, like filmmakers will just go out to a desert with a camera, a car, and a box of dynamite, and they'll blow up the car with the dynamite and film it, you know, which is probably a pretty dangerous thing to do, but they actually did that. They did it on a shoestring, they did it to entertain me. Or they'll find a stunt driver and they'll jump a car off of something and it'll flip over and then they'll make a hard edit and the car will blow up. That's going to be more exciting to me than all the CGI in the world. These big, long space battles where ships are just sort of soaring around. That's too polished for me. And that's just my personal preference. I understand that. Maybe some people do thrill to the sight of fleets of starships soaring around and blasting blasts at each other and just seeing all of this visual chaos. Not me. I want to see somebody blow up a car in a desert because somebody actually did that. It tells the story of its own making. The problem is a lot of these gigantic franchise entertainments like Star Trek, you know, they can't really work with that shoestring anymore. They're too well established. They need to be a little bit more sophisticated. They need to make better use of their budgets. And in so, there it is. There's that noise again where I'm just complaining. In so doing, we just sort of get these big, very slick movies that don't have a lot of thought in them. Section 31 Falls is actually not the first Star Trek movie to do this. A lot of Star Trek movies make the mistake of turning to action. That was the problem with all four of the Next Generation movies. And I've gone on record saying that I don't think any of the Next Generation movies are that great. Even Star Trek First Contact, I think, is a dumbed down action picture. It's decent, but a lot of it doesn't make any sense. The thought being, when you take Star Trek from the small screen to the big screen, you'll need to tell not just a bigger story, but also one that can be wrapped up within a 2-hour feature film. And the thought is, well, we need something even bigger and more dramatic happen in the movie than would happen in the show. The TV shows have already told some pretty big stories. They've looked at the infinity of the universe. They've traveled into other galaxies. They've met doppelgangers. There have been transporter accidents and space battles and politics. All of these things, gigantic things, are explored in these little one-hour miniature morality plays on the TV show. The thought to make a story, quote, more dramatic for feature film usually means that there has to be a lot more action. There has to be a lot more violence. There has to be just a lot more happenstance. You have a bigger budget now. You have more time to have those action sequences. This makes sense logically when you're sort of sussing out, how do we make a Star Trek movie? We clearly can't do the same kind of story we did on the show. So now we have to do something a little bit more movie, something a little bit more cinematic. And the immediate instinct is, let's have something a lot more shooty and a lot more, just so much more drama. There's just so much more emotions. The issue with that is that Star Trek has never been best when it's doing action. Star Trek is best when it's a little bit more thoughtful, when it's a little bit more character-oriented, when it's about the relationships between the characters and about the characters' relationship with this utopia that they're trying very, very hard to retain. I actually like especially on Star Trek The Next Generation, kind of in the original series, definitely not in Deep Space Nine, this idea that they have to avoid combat and war at all costs. There are many, many Next Generation stories about how some force in the galaxy, maybe the Romulans, are trying to start a war because they would benefit from it. They're a little bit more military. They want to be able to expand their territory and make use of all of their wartime resources. So they try to start a war, and it's about not how the Federation can come in and overpower them, but negotiate them or expose their evil plots to make sure the war does not break out. And the more dramatic stories are when they kind of tiptoe up to the brink of war and then very quickly saunter back, like they were able to stop all of that. It's not about domination. It's not about the power. It's not about the action. The movies are about war. The movies are about combat. The movies are about blowing up your enemies. They are about domination. And that's rather unfortunate that Star Trek has to do that. It's really unfortunate that the best transfer of the TV show to the big screen has been Star Trek the Motion Picture. You know, the boring one. Where they took the concepts and characters from the TV show, but blew it up, made everything bigger. Why do you think there's this 8-minute sequence where we're just sort of looking at the Enterprise? This is the first time we've really got to stare at it and appreciate its enormity and all of the details. Thing on the TV show, the Enterprise was a model that just sort of soared by the camera occasionally, and then it was a bunch of interior sets. In Star Trek The Motion Picture, we got to see little tiny people working on its exterior. We got to stare at it. We got to fly by it, really appreciate how big it was. It felt like a big version of the TV show. William has actually written very eloquently about this, about how Star Trek The Motion Picture is really kind of the idealized version of Star Trek The TV show. I say it's a problem because Star Trek The Motion Picture wasn't successful, or at least it wasn't as successful as Paramount wanted. And indeed, when it wasn't as successful as the studio had hoped. They kind of kicked Gene Roddenberry off of any additional movies. They brought in Nicholas Meyer to do Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. That's the really popular one. That one was a little bit more action-oriented. It was a little bit more naval, a little bit more military. I feel like the impression people took from Star Trek II was that it was this big action film, when really the action is very slow and subdued in that movie. But the stakes were really big, and they killed Spock, and that has sort of served as the template thereafter. But I think a lot of people misinterpreted Star Trek II, and when it came time to start making Next Generation movies a decade and a half later in the mid-90s, they decided, well, let's just do it. Let's do more violence. Let's do more vengeance-obsessed villains. And so we just started to fall into this unfortunate pattern of all these villains in Star Trek movies who want to take over the galaxy because of revenge. And now we have that again in the laziest possible fashion with Section 31. We've just echoed down, and now it's just this meaningless repetition of villain stories who want revenge and doomsday devices and action pictures without any kind of consideration whatsoever toward Star Trek at large. This is what this commentary track is for, guys. This is just so I can complain endlessly and endlessly and endlessly for almost an hour now about this really pretty terrible movie. I'm trying to think of, like, who do I know who really liked this film? I recall a critic friend of ours, Luke Y. Thompson, felt that it was fine as a B movie. And I suppose it is fine as a B movie. I think if they had released this on like the Sci-Fi Channel, and it wasn't a science fiction or a Star Trek movie, it was just a generic science fiction movie, that would've been fine. I think it would have been enjoyable. I'm trying to remember what details I had about the Section 31 TV series that was in development. There were whole episodes written about of the Section 31 TV series before it was reworked into a movie. It's important to remember that at this point in Star Trek history, the franchise was in a serious state of contraction. I mentioned earlier that there were 6 Star Trek shows running simultaneously. There was Discovery, Picard, Lower Decks, Prodigy, Short Treks, which was its own thing, and Strange New Worlds. All of those shows were running at the same time at one point. And thanks to, you know, writer strikes and the streaming wars, they kind of stretched themselves thin. These shows got way too expensive for the studio to handle. Paramount was in a lot of financial trouble, so they started to cancel off these shows one by one. Short Treks kind of petered out and, like, only reemerged as certain other projects. Discovery was canceled after its 5th season. Prodigy was canceled after its 2nd season and then removed from Paramount Plus altogether, which was a little frustrating. And this is why you'll probably see some Trekkies complaining about, you know, save Star Trek Prodigy. Lower Decks also canceled after its 5th season. That's finally at an end. Picard rather mercifully ended after its 3rd season. That was rarely good. Its third season had a pretty good story. That's the one where they kind of reunited the Next Generation cast. I didn't like the ending of that season. I'll complain about that in a different commentary track. But yeah, everything was just sort of coming to a close. The only ones that survived for a while were Strange New Worlds and Lower Decks. Then Lower Decks came to an end. As of this recording, Strange New Worlds is the only Star Trek show that survived. It's about to make its debut its 3rd season, and it's only going to last for 5 seasons. They said that was going to be the end of it. The press releases have said that was going to be the end. And also, as of this recording, they're working on a Starfleet Academy series. They've built sets, they've shot episodes. That's going to be coming at some point in the near future. And it looks like those might be the only 2 shows going forward. Only 2? Oh no. I mean, we're lucky to get 1. But yes, the decision to contract Section 31 from a TV series into a movie was part of this great contraction. There were all kinds of grand plans for Star Trek. There still might be a plan to do a Kelvinverse prequel. There's been some, I'm not exactly sure what a prequel would be at this point. We've already had Star Trek Enterprise. That was about the very first Starfleet vessel. J.J. Abrams' Star Trek was also about the young Kirk and the young Spock. That was also a prequel. And now we have Strange New Worlds, that's set immediately before the events of the original Star Trek. That's also a prequel. I don't know what other kinds of prequels they want to have, but there are some rumors that they're working on some other shows. Tawny Newsom, one of the actors from Lower Decks, is said to be working on a live-action Star Trek comedy series. I mean, that sounds like a bad idea, but, you know, Lower Decks sounded like a bad idea as well, and I ended up loving that show. It's kind of odd that the irreverent 30-minute animated comedy Star Trek series had much more of the spirit of the original Star Trek, or at least Next Generation era Star Trek, than anything like Section 31, which may as well not be Star Trek. We're about to have a knife fight and a torture scene, for goodness sake. This is more like 24. In every single scene, I can see the writers and see the filmmakers, and particularly I can see Alex Kurtzman just bristling at the idea of Star Trek's utopia. I just don't think he believed in it. I don't think he really understood it. I don't think he had any interest in exploring any kind of moral dimension to what this is. In those press releases, when he said it's a story of redemption, he just kind of pulled that out of his ass. This is not a story of redemption. This is not a story of righting wrongs. It's just a story of stuff. It's just stuff. This movie is nothing but stuff. Thank you. I'm a film critic. I have all of the best adjectives. Oh my gosh. Osun Sanmi has a lot of experience with Star Trek. He's directed several episodes of Discovery. He came from Gotham. He did several episodes of the TV series Gotham. He directed episodes of Sleepy Hollow. He directed six episodes of Falling Skies. He knows TV and he knows how to be efficient. As a director, he doesn't have much of a voice. I feel like he doesn't really bring anything to Star Trek that he wouldn't have brought to any of his other directing jobs. He's directed one feature film, a 2005 horror movie called The Cavern, a straight-to-video thing. I think because he's just such a workman, he's just such this journeyman director, he's also not bringing any of his own voice or any of himself to Star Trek. It's just a gig for him. It feels like it's just a gig for him anyway. Maybe he does. Maybe he loves it. Maybe there is something about Star Trek Discovery that he's really keying into, but I'm not seeing it on the screen, and I'm certainly not seeing it in Section 31. I keep crediting Alex Kurtzman as sort of like the central creative force. He's actually not even one of the writers on this. Craig Sweeney is the credited screenwriter, and he's also like a TV journeyman going way back. He did like episodes of Medium and the 4400. He did like 16 episodes of Elementary. He's done a lot. And he even did an episode of Discovery. The story is credited by two writers named Bo Yeon Kim and Erica Lippolt. I don't know what their exact involvement was in sort of developing the story, if they were developed it before production of the movie. I think Kim and Lippolt were the intended showrunners of Section 31, the TV series, and they came up with this story to be this season-long arc where there's going to be a lot more traveling and going about the galaxy and finding this doomsday device. I wouldn't have liked the story even if it had taken 10 episodes, but maybe there would have finally been that moment of that thing I was complaining about earlier, where we get to explore the Star Trek civilian universe. If we're actually sort of trekking around, doing some actual Star Trekking, and learning and discovering and following this long mystery, maybe it would have been a little bit more intriguing. Who's to say? But yeah, that wasn't their screenplay. I think it was just their plot. And here we are finally at the big, well, not even finally, there's a lot left of this movie. We're in the middle of a chase. A lot of those snap zooms. I'm not going to say that action is completely inappropriate to Star Trek. You have fantastical technologies. You have fantastical weapons. It's okay to have shootouts here and there. It's okay to have chases here and there. It just can't be the rise on deck of Star Trek. It can't be an action picture which is predicated on seeing these, quote, thrilling action scenes. I don't go to Star Trek to be thrilled. I go to Star Trek to be provoked, to have my mind opened a little bit, to consider things about the human condition that I hadn't considered before. I want to know what it's like to talk to a sentient hologram. I want to ponder what it would be like to consider there's a life form out there that is microscopic. What does that say about, you know, the future of technology and the types of life that are capable of growing in this great galaxy of ours? No. So little of that. There's no time to think or stop or talk about anything other than the plot. Oh, my God. Kurtzman and Osun Sanmi have talked about how this was inspired by Mission Impossible. And golly, is that not the case? And by Mission Impossible, I think they mean the Tom Cruise movies and not the original TV series. The original TV series was a little bit more terse, and it was also a lot more team-oriented. The Mission Impossible movies were a little bit more about Ethan Hunt and his bold heroism and how he led up this spy, this cadre of rogue spies as they went on these world-saving missions. The thing about Ethan Hunt is that he is constantly referred to in dialogue as the living manifestation of destiny. He is constantly told about how, you know, he's reckless, but also his heroism is really admirable, that he's always tries to protect the ones he loves, but he can't always protect the ones he loves, but his heroism is the thing getting him in trouble. He's always spoken about in these very glowing terms. Tom Cruise produced those series, but that series, by the way, in case you couldn't tell. Empress Georgiou is a monster. She is not spoken of as the living manifestation of destiny. She's not a super capable action heroine. She is a monster. She's a murderer. She's a mass murderer. You don't get to play by those same rules when you're dealing with non-noble characters. She is unreliable. She doesn't do the right thing. Sometimes she begrudgingly does something that has a good outcome, but she didn't do it because she wanted to be noble. And again, that could be an interesting character, but she's just so poorly written in this movie that none of that is coming out. None of the intrigue of having a villain at the center of a Star Trek series is coming out. Oh gosh, the comparisons they made on all of these press releases. They compared it to Mission Impossible. They compared it to Guardians of the Galaxy. That makes sense. They compared it to Unforgiven. No. Unforgiven is actually a very morally complex movie about how the former gunslinger was actually trying to go straight. And that's not where we found Empress Georgiou. She wasn't living in this space casino trying to stay away from villainy, cleansing herself and trying to do good by the world. No, she was still being villainous and eating eyeballs. This has nothing to do with Unforgiven. I think a big part of why this couldn't be a series was because Michelle Yeoh was busy. She's been in so many movies. I feel like even Kurtzman was run a little ragged, because he was like sort of scooping up people from a lot of other TV shows that he had worked on. Craig Sweeney, the credited screenwriter, had previously worked on the TV series Limitless, which was one of Kurtzman's projects, if I understand correctly. And they were just sort of like throwing pages out of already written scripts and kind of pushing it down into something that was a feature film. There was a time when Kurtzman really, really believed in this. It was this one. It was Starfleet Academy, both of which are spinoffs of Discovery. Discovery is his baby. You'll find whenever Alex Kurtzman talks about But anyway, going back to, I know Kurtzman isn't the actual writer, but he does feel like the mastermind behind all of this. He didn't write, he didn't direct, but this is his. This one's in his lap. Yeah, and there was a time when he wanted Discovery, Section 31, and his Starfleet Academy, all of these spinoffs of the same of Discovery, to be sort of like the core of the new Star Trek universe. And because everything was falling apart, and because fans demanded other things, and because other creative teams were being brought in, it just didn't really click together, I think, the way he wanted. So they had animated shows instead. They had a greater variety of Star Trek shows. I'm so glad they brought in Lower Decks. I hated the idea of Lower Decks, then I saw Lower Decks, and I loved Lower Decks. And Section 31 was going to be right at the center of all of this. This sort of bleak Star Trek. I recently saw a production of Hamlet that took sort of a fresh angle on the material. The first half of the play was all of the scenes in Hamlet with Hamlet in them. All of the scenes without Hamlet weren't staged. Hamlet was just on stage the entire time, and it was Shakespeare's language. Then halfway through, we got to see there was a shift in the play. Everything had ended, everybody was dead, and then a detective entered the scene, and the play switched into modern language, and they kind of reinterrogated a lot of the things that happened that Hamlet wasn't privy to. And the whole joke of the play was Hamlet's actually kind of this self-important a-hole who caused all of this death, and actually all the other characters had a lot more going on and had different views of the play than we had previously considered. Some of the reviews referred to it as, you know, it's clearly not your father's Hamlet, but Hamlet's old and classical. How many not your father's Hamlets have we had in the last couple of centuries? This thing is constantly being re-explored. This is not like so fresh a new angle that we can be impressed by the ideas that the playwrights were clearly going for. This is just another not your father's Hamlet. I feel like the same thing is not that Star Trek and Hamlet are artistically of the same caliber, but I feel like we're dealing with something very similar here. Star Trek has been around since 1966. It's nearly 60 years old at this point. It's been rebooted. There have been 12 TV shows. There have been 14 movies. There's a lot of new angles to take on this, and they have done it plenty of times. Star Trek The Next Generation fast-forwarded the action by almost a century. Star Trek Deep Space Nine took things off of a ship, had stories that were a lot more about politics and war. The only one that was really classically Star Trek since the original show was Voyager, weirdly enough, which, you know, had its own problems. But then we had sort of the new CBS All Access / Paramount Plus era that began in 2017. They redesigned the Klingons. They changed the tone of things. It was an all new creative team. Everything was a lot more action oriented. There was a lot more violence and darkness, and there was cussing and nudity now all of a sudden in Star Trek. We're trying to make it, you know, that much fresher. But how many not your father's Star Treks do we need anymore? How many times do we need to shift things toward the dark? I've been complaining about this for many, many years. I wrote an essay maybe 15 years ago about the character of Batman. My favorite Batman movie is the Leslie Martinson film from 1966, the one with Adam West. I like that one because it is just pure entertainment. It is this sublime comedy, this kind of send-up of police purity, this celebration of subversive sexuality and the fun of crime. The villains are having a blast in those Batman movies. There's a lot going on in Batman that I really love. And I got really frustrated with the modern tendency to take these kid-friendly things or these fantasy entertainments and to make them, quote, dark. The idea of turning something into something darker and more violent is somehow making it more mature. Okay, sure, a little kid can't watch something that has a lot of violence, but really it's just adolescent. The idea of the thought that turning something into a kid-friendly thing into something dark and violent is somehow making it better is actually very immature. That's actually not analyzing that these things are actually very appealing for much more sophisticated reasons. Even if they're kid-friendly, they can still be very sophisticated. Taking away the sophistication and focusing just on the darkness and the violence and the bleakness and the immoralities of the universe makes it less interesting to me. I don't care how dark a Batman story gets. Can we have a lightened up Batman story? It's rare that it happens the other way, when something really dark and bleak and violent gets turned into something light and fun. Let's see if I can think of some examples. Teen Titans. The animated series Teen Titans was adapted into a TV series called Teen Titans Go. One was actually a little bit headier and animated to be a little bit more realistic and a little bit more conventionally action superhero stories, whereas Teen Titans Go was a broad cartoonish slapstick comedy series. That can happen sometimes. That happened with Lower Decks. Star Trek was in this really bleak, violent place, and here was a light-hearted version of the same thing. But there is an unfortunate tendency, and I think it's very lazy, to take something that's really bright and optimistic and try to gain a new audience by making it dark and violent. The new audience thing is a big issue, and Kurtzman has gone on record with the idea that Trekkies are aging out. He has said in interviews that Star Trek's audience is only getting older and new fans aren't coming in. And if he only continued to focus on the extant Trekkies, the franchise overall would just contract and die out. It's contracting and dying out anyway. But his thought was they need to change Star Trek into something completely new, something that the old fans don't like, because he feels that mainstream audiences want this. He thinks fans want Section 31. He thinks mainstream audiences want stuff like Section 31. These brisk, meaningless, violent action pictures about ragtag villains who murder each other. I think that's what he likes. And I think he feels that's the only way to get new people on board with Star Trek. He doesn't understand that we're already here and we want something that's Star Trek. It's okay to change it around a little bit, but it's not okay to turn it into bland, dumb, thoughtless action pictures with no regard to the very ideas behind Star Trek that made the TV shows and the movies interesting to begin with. Look, I've seen so much Star Trek, and I know it can be done. I know you can keep on telling these kinds of stories year in and year out and still have it be kind of fundamentally based on the same notions and the same ideas and the same philosophies. These ideas of technological utopia, these ideas of Starfleet as a workplace, these ideas of diplomacy and peace being the ultimate goods worth fighting for. All of those things can be in place, and you can still tell a grand and wide variety of stories. Kurtzman disagrees with me. Kurtzman seems to think that people want to watch Michelle Yeoh, like she is in the scene, stabbing a guy through the stomach that she used to know as a child, and you know, doing flips over background on shaking sets while doomsday devices are about to go off. All of these really boring old action tropes. If Kurtzman felt that way, but he were actually making a Star Trek movie that was as exciting and made with such action virtuosity as a Mission Impossible film, he might have a point. He might be able to tell something that doesn't feel at all like Star Trek, but actually functions really well in a different way. A lot of people feel that way about those Abrams movies. They don't feel like Star Trek, but a lot of people like how slick they are and like the sexiness of the young cast and the big emotions and the soaring of the spaceships and the laser battles. A lot of people like the virtuosity and the action filmmaking that went into that. If Section 31 had action choreography as creative and as good as a Mission Impossible film, maybe I wouldn't be complaining so much. I would probably still be complaining about how, oh, they're trampling all over my precious Star Trek and they're not giving regard to all of the big ideas. But I would at least have to acknowledge that what I'm seeing is pretty great action, that it's trying to tell a different kind of a story. And if it was actually moving me on an action level, then I wouldn't be complaining so much. But what I'm seeing in Section 31, the movie, is kind of lazy action, kind of uninteresting ideas, cheap ways to get to uncreatively filmed action sequences. Everything feels very rote. Everything feels very automated. And it's dealing with really boring ideas like doomsday devices. Okay, you have a doomsday device. So what? I've seen too many G.I. Joe cartoons to be impressed by your doomsday device. I mean, at least we have this scene here where Rachel Garrett finds, like, a doll with, you know, a widget inside of it. Okay, a doll. Mm-hmm. One visual thing. One interesting visual thing. But yeah, now we're shaking the camera and there's fires going off and I just don't care. At the end of this movie, the implication is, like, this was going to be their first adventure, right? Maybe we can think of this movie as the pilot for the Section 31 TV series that never got made. And they were going to gallivant around the galaxy, getting into more misadventures. Golly, I wish I wanted to see more of these characters. They didn't really do enough to establish their backstories, who they are as people, why I would be interested in and who these people are, where they came from, why they've taken on this mission. Their relationships aren't very well fleshed out, the way they sort of get along with one another on an everyday basis. And this, again, this is something I've complained about on the podcast plenty of times, this idea that too many TV shows and movies are so full of action and incident that we don't get a good baseline reading as to what life is like when they're having downtime, when nothing is happening. I like a couple of stories here and there where nothing of, like, huge dramatic significance happens, because those are the moments when we get to sort of explore the ship where these characters live, or explore the relationships they have to one another, see how what they do in their spare time, what they're doing on their day off. Or, you know, do they get to have a day off? Maybe they can't have trouble relaxing. Those things will speak a lot to their characters and a lot of what how they relate to one another. Because this is a 95-minute movie, and because these characters are just sort of introduced very hastily, we get nothing but shorthand, and the shorthand is not that interesting. They don't even get to say, like, really clumsy bits of dialogue. Oh, well, I was found in a cauldron on a distant world, and nobody knows where I came from. Or, oh yes, I've been working very hard to work my way to this, and then something was very was interrupted, and now I'm forced to come here, and I hate all of you people. Like, none of those things, even these basic lines of dialogue to explore these characters' backstories, are given. The only backstory we're given is Empress Georgiou, and we only learn that she has this character out of her past and that she came from a planet where she had to engage in the Hunger Games to become an empress. But, you know, she never got to say anything about how she felt about being empress. Some of that was explored on Discovery, but not in any kind of meaningful way. And it's certainly not part of this movie. The characters aren't just uninteresting, but they don't relate very well. There can be some magical alchemy to casting. Maybe if you cast the right actors who just sort of had a certain kind of electric chemistry, maybe they could communicate a lot through just simple looks, or the way they related to one another, the way they glanced at each other in a little bit of a cutaway. Even those things would have fleshed out a character. And we don't even get that in Section 31. We just get people without a lot of interesting backstories doing a lot of stuff. Oh my gosh. Is there a way we can move forward with Star Trek? I mean, yes, I'm too much of a Trekkie to think that we should give up on it. I mean, maybe we should. Maybe it's time to just put the entire franchise down. Maybe wait a little bit. live with what we have. I think there is something that can be done with modern special effects technology. I love what they're doing on Star Trek Strange New Worlds. They moved back to episodic stories. The tone is actually kind of light on that one. It's almost a comedy show. There are some serious episodes, but you know, Spock is now a little bit more of a comedy character. He's a lot more passionate in that show. Good Star Trek can still be made. Strange New Worlds is proving that. But unless you were going to have Strange New Worlds or a show like it in perpetuity, and until Paramount is willing to give us more than just 10 quick episodes per season and then a few years in between seasons, it's never going to match. That is, Star Trek is never going to match sort of the glory days of when we had the glut of it in the 1990s. Part of that, I admit, is just nostalgia. That's when I was watching the most Star Trek as a teenager in the 1990s, and it became a big part of my life at that time. I can't pretend that, you know, a big part of what I'm complaining about is just me being a grumpy old man longing for the glory days. But at the same time, I can also recognize when good stories and bad stories are being told, and some good stories are being told, and I think that the model they had back in the 1990s of giving us 26 episodes per season sort of forced them to give us those down episodes, those bottle episodes, those ones where we could explore relationships between the characters. With only 10 episodes per season, that time is severely limited. So until we can spend more time with people and live in Star Trek for an extended period, we're not going to have quite the same quality as some of the older shows. Lower Decks, Strange New Worlds, you did it. You nailed it. Great. Do more of that. It doesn't have to be nostalgia-based. It doesn't have to be legacy characters. It can be all new characters. Just tell episodic stories that explore the relationships between these characters. Have episodes that are big, have episodes that are small. And don't be afraid to make a Star Trek movie, like Section 31, that is a little bit slower and more thoughtful. It doesn't have to be action all the time. You don't need to grab us with action, especially Trekkies, especially young people. Not everybody's going to want necessarily just to see the same spin on Guardians of the Galaxy time and time again. And we're not all going to want to see, you know, just references to old Star Trek shows. We can stand it. We can stand new stories. We can stand new ideas within our Star Trek in a slow, thoughtful, interesting, intriguing way. We want bigger sci-fi ideas. We don't just want Michelle Yeoh with a scar on her cheek holding a doomsday device. This is like maybe the one moment in Section 31 where there's some soul to it, just because these characters get to have, finally at the end of the day, after everything's been killed, a quiet moment. But yeah, I'm not really sure if Star Trek can carry on with this kind of story. I think if you stay away from stuff like Section 31, wherever Section 31 is, go in the opposite direction. Go into something really kind of slow. I've said before, my ideal Star Trek series, something so dense, so scientifically and intellectually dense, that I need to do reading after every episode, that I need to look up what certain philosophical or scientific concepts are. Really, really make my brain hurt with Star Trek. That's what I want to see. I don't want to see Section 31. Clearly nobody wanted to see Section 31. This was kind of the end of it for Star Trek. As soon as Strange New Worlds ends, time will tell. We'll see if that sitcom gets off the ground. We'll see if Starfleet Academy becomes popular. Maybe they've learned their lesson. Maybe Starfleet Academy is going to be about study and character and not about action and conspiracies. I like the idea of including a Starfleet officer. I don't think it necessarily had to be Rachel Garrett. Just having somebody who was standing for right amongst the team. I think if they were the leader, that would have been great. Or they were like at least the first officer, somebody who could rein in Philippa Georgiou. That would have been interesting. But Rachel Garrett and Emperor Georgiou, you know, okay, they're hugging. Why? When did this happen? When did they become fond of one another? They never had any moments together where they really got to communicate. Section 31 pulls the same crap that Discovery did, and that there were a lot of really big emotional moments where characters cried and talked about being a family, but we never got to see them grow close. We only ever saw them in crisis mode. You guys are my family. Captain Michael Burnham would cry and sort of talk to her crew, but I barely knew any of those characters' names. We never got to see them actually bond. Yeah, Section 31, these characters don't bond. They can say that they did, but I never really saw it. I never really felt it. And so now that was it. A couple weeks pass, and now the characters are all hanging out. They're back on the ship, and this is when Jamie Lee Curtis shows up and says, okay, you guys are a team now, and you're going to go on further adventures. This was just a pilot. That's a fine scene to have at the end of a pilot episode. It's also a cute tease in case they ever want to do a sequel. But given that this wasn't too super successful, wasn't well reviewed, and they probably couldn't get Michelle Yeoh back ever, it's just sort of a cute little wink at this point. It's not any actual promise of what's going to happen. If I can complain about something that's in the movie, not just sort of the concept of the movie itself, the Fuzz character, the microscopic character who's piloting this human suit, I hate his performance. He has sort of like this big wild accent at the beginning, and then he shows up at the end as a new character who just happens to look like still looks like Sven Roygrok, like he got two of the same bodies to pilot. But then all of a sudden he has this like really broad Southern accent. I think they explain why he has these wild accents. I think the actor was just sort of playing around. Oh gosh. And yeah, now they're all friends and I don't understand why. I don't understand what these characters see in each other. I don't understand the attraction they have to one another. I don't think they necessarily worked well together. There was no sense of teamwork. At least in something like Guardians of the Galaxy, you got the sense that these characters were growing fond of each other, even if they didn't like each other. They became friends in spite of themselves. These characters aren't friends. Sam Richardson's the only one who has any kind of personality. Michelle Yeoh is just sort of hamming it up in her supervillain mode. Omari Hardwick is a little too stoic. Again, this is not necessarily the actor's fault. This is, you know, just sort of the result of the script and the tone and the direction. Just because I hate Sven Roygrok's performance doesn't mean he is an incapable actor. I'm sure he's fine elsewhere. They're two broad archetypes, and they don't really get to dig into the characters very deeply because there isn't a lot to dig into. And then they also killed Humberly Gonzalez's character. So yeah, one of the more intriguing characters was killed off right at the beginning. At the very end, it's going to be revealed that this like casino that they live on folds up and can soar around the galaxy as a ship itself. I wish they'd introduced that earlier. That would have been cool if their home base was this like space casino and they had to do battle and operations out of what was essentially a nightclub where people were still kind of hanging around. That would have been kind of fun. No, none of that. You have one base and you can explore that space, and you explore the space, you spend more time with the characters, stay in one spot, have a home base. That's, you know, TV writing 101. Maybe I'm old fashioned. I know I'm old fashioned. I'm an old man. I'm in my late 40s. I complain about Star Trek. I just spent an hour and a half complaining about Star Trek. But, you know, there are some things that have worked. If you can find a better way to do it, do that. But they didn't do it here. Anyway, there's a Jamie Lee Curtis telling her co-star that you guys are on an adventure now. And we're going to soar off into the stars. Golly, it's a bad movie. It's a chore to get through. Thanks for watching it with me, though. Thanks for joining me for Section 31 and Space the Final Frontier, but none of that. I can complain about Star Trek all day. I can complain about Star Trek for at least 93 minutes, as you have now heard. Thanks for listening. If you want to write a letter or complain about anything that I just did, if you think these solo commentary tracks are a little boring, let us know. But yeah, you can send us an email to letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. If you want to send us a postcard or a letter or any kind of physical mail, you can send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064. I've been Whitney Seibold. Thank you for listening to my commentary track. William will be back soon enough. Talk to you soon. Live long and prosper.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.